So welcome to the Jerome Stern Distinguished Writers Series. Thanks for being here.
Before we get started, we do have a couple rules to remind you. Please don't smoke in the warehouse. Please turn off all cell phones and headphones. And also, please try not to get up during the reading. We will take a 10-minute break in between readers.
So up first to introduce Damian Caudill is Jamie Ringleb.
How's it going? Good, excellent. Oh. All right. Whenever I write one of these introductions, I always feel, in describing a poet's approach to their poems, the need to speak to how those poems are in conversation with thematic or formal models traceable in what we think of as canonical literature. And Damian Caudill does use his poetry to enter into those conversations. His speakers and characters are often invented, and so he perhaps is most clearly in line with writers of persona poems and dramatic monologues. And what's more, he's interested in hidden characters, characters whose nuance as people would often be erased by stereotype, marginalization, or any of a number of different forms of social difficulty. There is, in this, an engagement on the part of Damian's poetry with older traditions that extend from I to Gwendolyn Brooks to Wordsworth to Theocritus, poets whose characters are suppressed or considered unmentionable by the cultures these characters endure. And so I planned only to tell you what his characters look like and Damian's approach to them, how relentlessly generous he is in giving us a full and nuanced characterization or set of characterizations in only a few stanzas, how his poems are completely unwilling to reduce the characters he invents to any form of stereotype, and how the overall effect of the poems is to question into and reveal subcultures and identities that exist where we expect them not to. Yes, a particular thread of his poems, for example, seem to remind us there are still queers in rural regions of red states, and yes, sometimes people are even nice to them. And while I do love the commentary and surprise, it's true. While I do love the commentary and surprise that these situational or character-based juxtapositions and explorations offer Damian's poetry, I was struck reading through the packet of poems Damian will be reading tonight, how so many of them are elegiac in their enactments or responses to grief and loss. Whether his speakers lament the loss of an abusive gay relationship or the loss of a husband in the collapse of a mountain in the Upper Big Branch mine disaster, or the loss of Trayvon Martin imagined through the perspective of the hoodie he was wearing when he was murdered. So many of the poems Damian writes are poems of mourning, elegiac explorations of a specific, often social disaster, made all the more disastrous by the fact that, hopefully less in contemporary poetry, but certainly in many Western poetic movements and voices, these types of losses seem to have been neglected. Damian's poems are social lamentations, and their intention is to fulfill the social mourning that are in many ways foundational to the elegy, which is to acknowledge that grief is not only personal, but based in community, and that our responsibility as members of that community is to acknowledge, understand, and fully mourn our losses. What I love most, though, about Damian's poems is their delicate, sometimes playful, but always deeply intimate handling of the various speakers and characters they take on. This is where the mask of persona falls slightly away, and where the real-life Damian begins to shine through. And seeing that intimacy, particularly in combination with the social responsibility and obligation to the complexity of human lives that Damian's poems explore, is, for me, the biggest pleasure of the poems. The poems love their speakers, and the underlying process of the poems is finding several different ways to love their speakers better, which speaks to what may be the most foundational and human endeavor I know, to, in all this loss and grieving, give value and love to those who need it, and to give it comprehensively and generously. Damian Caudill is a recent Florida transplant from the foothills of Ohio. His work has appeared in Rattle, Ninth Letter, Pleiades, and Best New Poets 2015, a selection of his creative and critical work was recently featured in the anthology It Was Written, Poetry Inspired by Hip Hop. Please help me welcome him to the stage.
So thank you, Jamie. I think if nothing else, that description describes exactly what I'm trying to aspire to in my poetry, what's important to me. So in that way, I think it's the perfect introduction. All right, so I'll read 8 or 9 poems. As Jamie was kind of speaking to, many of them are kind of narrative or persona-based poems. A lot of them move back and forth between place and time and perspective. All right. So this first poem deals with a historical event in Ohio, where I'm from, in Cleveland specifically, and it's called Endeavor, Ohio. It's 1969, and you're the Cuyahoga River, or rather, you're the river's Damson Oil Hickey, which isn't really the river anymore, but what's on top of it, a chemical blaze compassing east. Confession, river. You look sensational in Time magazine, modeling first as liquid, then again as gas. All those men trying to put out water with more water. You, of course, make the Tonight Show monologue. You make Randy Newman's copper microphone on a song they play in Louis's bar, where the union men listen through their buzz, then bless you with another. One starved spark in you, of all unnatural disasters, finally bring the EPA up to full regulatory speed. In April, the State House lowers a tub of money for rehabilitation. All summer, the pier sits empty on you. We watch the weather rolling into Cleveland from bigger, better waters. You in your government green dress, me in my same blue work clothes, Lake Erie a knot of smog and steam. River, know that I'm still gallant in my damp heart, steering the coal barge around the scientists' data fat machines. Know this, all of our children have russet skin that flakes in whatever fickle breeze. All suffer chipped teeth. At night, when I pull my hands back from your bay, each finger cramps with mercury, worries the wheel to dust as I drive home across your eye beams. It's 1970 now, and you're still the Cuyahoga River. Or rather, you're a running faucet in my bloodstream. It's Monday again, and I'm still a working man. Or rather, I'm the rubber stopper in the slop bucket sink. All right, so this next poem, Jamie mentioned this as well. It's a poem I wrote, I guess, back in the summer of 2012, which was 2 or 3 months after the murder of Trayvon Martin. And the poem itself is from the perspective of the hoodie he was wearing at the time. And as I'm sure many of you remember, that became a big part of the narrative around the violence enacted upon him. It's called Tuesday Ordinary. And there's a preface before it. So Tuesday Ordinary. I think the hoodie is as much responsible for Trayvon Martin's death as George Zimmerman was. Geraldo Rivera speaking on Fox and Friends, March 23rd, 2012. The storm clouds are glaring blue today, but we walked the blocks to the gas station anyway. The stone polishing sweat of you in my pocket, my throwback cotton blend, my name fucking brandness. When you put me on, I hang loose from your body. Because even in February, this is still boiling Florida, and we have survived, after all, our whole lives here, ground into parking lots like asphalt and beach sand from better places. You know I hate the closet and the bedroom floor, hate that there are months when you don't pull me on over ratty t-shirts or the kick of new cologne. No doubt the snow won't show up again this year. How much I want to lock in the stick-thin heat of you, to keep out whatever bad day is always, always following us home. And I do love the fat sidewalks in Sanford, love that we tore them alone during weekdays built like intermissions, the whole town slouched down in their seats, every neighbor calling out for backup as we pass. All right. This next poem is called Asking After You. Derivative as blocking the driveway with your truck so I can't leave, or we'll have to trundle through the yard. Damn daffodils, damn lilac. What kept us running, the yellow-bellied yield in me, or those gentle nights when you could still be tugged into sleep? Simple syrup of cum and moonlight, resignation to the crater of our sink. Daniel, this could never work, not in this first lifetime, stuck between the medicine cabinet and back to bed until afternoon rots, tequila blonde at our window. How blown to bits we always were. Remember Timberwolves on the drive to Tacoma? Remember your DUIs? Was that 08 or 09, your birthday or mine? I only remember the wall-mounted telephone in our bathroom, the little back balcony where I'd sit and watch your friends, the cops, console you. Daniel, it's been morning all day here, and the birds still call me by my old name. It's no wonder that they miss you so. Summer nights, we woke them with our first song. Chuck Berry stomping roaches in the kitchen. Our good days, always the best argument against sleep. Us, they're saying to me now. We. All right, so this next poem is a poem that's about where I'm from, which is the kind of border region between Southern Ohio and West Virginia. It's called Eulogy Rolled Up. Jody died with her foot on the pedal, kept revving until you both choked. Wet November and the ambulance dragging ass across the neighbor's cornfield. Completely odorless, how the police told it then. Not rotten like gas leaks, gray egg of caution abandoned in the coop. How low that dual exhaust hung down on your truck, chrome pair of lungs sunken in mud, hardware of respiration. Out here, nobody thinks to crack a window. Nobody stops drinking long enough to smoke. Jody blew a gasket in the end, though you were already slipping off and couldn't stay. I don't believe you'd have stopped her, though, spinning her four wheels as the radio cut out. Monoxide, you see, is a fullness you have to swallow, like daybreak in that way, like oxygen's chug-a-lug guilt. This next poem is about one of my friends back home in Ohio who ended up serving, I guess, a total of three and a half tours between Afghanistan and Iraq. And this kind of deals with the resulting changes in his personality after that experience. It's called Trigger. It's for my friend Ben. Trigger. Again, with the semi-automatic snare drum fill, when all I wanted was to step out for some air with you. Burnout foxholes the DJ drops into, and dirt roads to Mosul stand for nothing a hillbilly doesn't already know about remoteness. Nights we played Call of Duty before you left, and isn't back home the worst place you'll ever be asked to be again? Understand, I don't know anything firsthand. So remind me again how bullets tell the body to take a hike when they breeze through the head. Beer in the fridge if you'd like to stay longer. But out past Gallipolis, the cornfields are gone to deer. All the yellow ribbon mothers too tired to shave the month from their legs. So leave your gun with Corey, but bring a flashlight in your jacket and your notebook. Charcoal kill lists you mapped out on each page. Throw their names like IEDs against the black sky bunker. It's rubble that orders a body to crawl through. All right. So this next poem is another poem about home. It's called Stent. Stent. Brother, you could have nailed down anything. every honky-tonk widow, every foreign exchange we rolled our beefy tongues toward. What small ponds we drink from here, green fish we catch in our mouths as we swim circles around debt. Like summer jobs or the cable, you always dropped out on us. Slack muscles I watched you hem with a belt, truck beds you'd climb into just to needle away the blues. What could I do then when all you left me was a body without a fix? When the hospital leads to jail and jail's the only trick a man could ask of you? Long hours we put into flesh here. How sobriety bends the arm behind your back. How morning lays off every dream. All right, so I got three more. This next one's a little bit longer than the other two. And I think Jamie alluded to this in his introduction, but this one is about the Upper Big Branch mine disaster, which happened in Mount Cole, West Virginia in 2010. And for those of you who aren't familiar with kind of the nature of mine disasters, it's not something that's often very survivable. And in this case, all 29 of the miners who were down in the mine at the time of the collapse died. But this is kind of an imagined dialogue between one of those miners who would have been trapped down there and his partner above ground. So it's called At Rest, a Black Diamond. Dot, today they brought the mountain down on us. We were mining coal where coal lives, and then they brought it down. Over and over, I thought of you separating the lights and darks in the wash, your house, your rules. And if I left my jeans on the bathroom floor, know that I'm sorry. Soot like a blanket, and my eyes can't tell solid ground from slag or swill or any body. Joey. Today, I brought the hounds in from the barn. I imagine it's cold year-round in the corked bottle where they left you. Other sad bastards have camped out for weeks in the state house, but around here nothing changes. Water from the tap, more metal than wet. Breeze from the mine, more blanket than wind. Over and over I pick seams of hair from the laundry. Your good shirt, your bluer jeans. And if they let a widow among us visit you there, we drive up in our Chevys, kick the living shit from the earth. We'd bust the gut on cheap whiskey. We'd order a bullet, then pray for just one more. Dot. The mountain state is a state of disrepair. Politicians dote for days on new street lamps in Charleston, while seismographs occupy rooms all their own above Kanawha and Boone and here. What makes men dream of progress? Sheep jumping red tape, company light pumped into a company store. Greed has always been measured in watts, incandescence nursed from less than pay dirt. I'll stop with that one. All right, so two more. This next one is a little different than the ones I've read so far. It's called Singles Party, and it's about a singles party, ostensibly. All right, so Singles Party. What's worse is that the pirate didn't have any idea about the trade winds this time of year. Guess I should have expected imposters on Halloween. Guess I was drunk. But he was so much like you, his granite hair, his full mast of muscles in the dark. It was always cinematic for me, standing alone on the mezzanine with a fierce wind and downpour I never expected. Bluster is my sails from the margaritas I drank doubled. Bluster the bartender pressing glasses into plates of spinning salt. Whatever Ellie says about sustainability at the farmer's market tomorrow is all fine and good, but the blockhead mahi-mahi will look like frauds on their beds of ice. You never saw me work a fillet knife, did you? You would have remembered how I peeled the swaths of blue and green into the white petal of our sink. Summer back then, and how could I have known how familiar you'd feel by January? Like, here is boy's mug, here boy's sewing machine, here saffron in the cupboard, of course. I forgot everything I learned in the hour between broken glass at the bar and sleep again with you. All right, so this is my last one. So this one is about back home as well. It's called Lament with No Idea Where to Find You. They go to the river first, the entire town scanning for a body and finding a tire, a snag of fishing line, a different body missing teeth, knocking its antlers against a sunken fiberglass canoe. Spread out now, they cover more ground in pairs, hunting the flock of breaths that desert an old man wearing a linen robe, fleece slippers, no gloves nor lingering sense of self at all. How they look nothing like themselves on local TV, creeping the hillsides and burn fields like explorers, grown-up sons who've never found a reason to leave the state, their own teenage daughters too sober by half, always looking up at the diminishing November sky. And my own parents, always a part of this tradition too, picking at the ground with walking sticks, spinning their flashlights into each other's faces by habit when they stop to talk the weather out of its enormity. By now we know every erased mind is woefully familiar. Why shouldn't we expect to find our grandparents smoking in the football stands or eating breakfast at Milo's Diner? After all, we're sure that's where we'd go. Our bare feet eating fresh snow, our hands two crimes we no longer have a name for. This is how it should happen, we think. Not sunken heavy at the bottom of a canal, but asleep in center field. Frozen beneath stars we'll suspect only just appeared.
All right. About 2 years ago, I was walking into my first ever graduate workshop here at FSU. I was eager, grateful, and more than a little bit nervous. While looking around the classroom that day, there appeared to be a few other students in a similar position to me, but also some seemingly more experienced writers too, writers that had been in the program for a while. And just glancing at that impressive beard and buttery smooth head of his, I figured Danilo was one of those writers. Most likely my strongest memory from that class is returning to my apartment after my very first workshop and reading Danilo's critique of my short story. Actually, I can still to this day recall a specific line from that letter. Danilo said, among other things, that one of my characters was, quote, void of all life, end quote. And so for about the next month, I pretty much hated him. And what made this juvenile and brief resentment toward Danilo even worse, other than him being right, was that I was absolutely unable to ignore the massive amount of talent he possessed. He'd bring in these stories that were just drenched with life. And how strange they were, too. That's one of the things I love about fiction, the bizarre, the weird, and Danilo's work is loaded with that. Whether it be a story where a father attempts to thread a nerve ending into his son's gum line to reattach a lost tooth, or where a young man seeks revenge on the crack addicts that murdered his girlfriend on an empty Montana highway, or where a nun boxes her students in a school's bathroom stall, or my personal favorite, where a performance group titled Strength in Christ toured the country, bending rebar into crucifixes for the little kids to take home with them. And by the way, all of that that I just mentioned is in just one story. I could talk about Danilo's work, how challenging it is, how muscular, how it embodies the word power in every way possible. But I'd also like to take a second to talk about him as a person, because to me, that's even more important. Danilo is one of the few people I know where, when I see a photo of him lovingly holding his one-year-old daughter, Paget, in his arms, or when I catch sight of him and his wife, A.B., also a tremendously talented artist, smiling and laughing away outside of a reading, or when I see him at a party passionately conversing with another young writer, I can't help but think to myself that this is a good man, that this is someone I should pay attention to, listen to, learn from his advice, his experiences. So I guess what I'm saying is Danilo isn't just a great writer, but a great person as well, and I'm honored to be able to call him my colleague and friend. Danilo John Thomas was born and raised in Southwest Montana. His second chapbook, The Hand Implements, is forthcoming from the cupboard. A.B. Gorham handmade editions of his first chapbook, Merc, and his work can most recently be found in Heavy Feather Review and Waccamaw. He will shortly be moving to Reno, Nevada with his family. You'll be greatly missed. Now let's welcome Danilo Thomas up to the stage.
How's everybody doing? Thanks for coming. Thanks to Matt and Whitney. You guys don't get enough cred for running this show. Thanks for reading with me, Damien. I've never read a word of Damien's poetry or heard any before tonight, and it's strangely how I've been to that place. So two jokes, because the story is sort of bleak. What does a bird wear to the party? A tuxedo. How do dinosaurs pay their rent? That would be a good answer. Tyrannosaurus checks. All right, so. Into the blood and mayhem. Here we go. A little caveat about this. I've written a series of stories that are named out after lesser-known mythical creatures because I feel like some of the weird shit that gets invented by people doesn't get its proper due. Title of the story is The Amphisbania, which is a double-headed snake, a snake on the head and a snake on the tail with wings in the center. No legs, and it feeds off the dead, and it was created in the desert from blood dripping from the head of the Medusa as Perseus flew over, and that's just some crazy shit, but it reminds me a lot of, like, sorrow and despair and guilt and things like that. So anyway, the Amphisbania. Pinpurse looted a train. A story of unlocked train cars blew into Maloney's bar with the winter winds, and before Reason had time to find purchase, Pinpurse and the boys had backed their trucks right up to the platform so quickly and easily that removing the car's contents seemed legal and right and damn near dutiful. Turned out that the cars were full, box on box, of beer. And when each truck had gathered its maximum payload, they peeled off with their plunder, rounding icy corners and raced into the night. 150 cases, the paper said, worth $2,000, the first train heist of the 21st century. The morning keeps few secrets in small towns, however, and fewer still when pride's involved, especially with so many native sons scrambling for a reputation. Everybody let each other know exactly who was in on the job and exactly how they'd done it, the comical ease on which it was accomplished. As it happens, however, a $2,000 heist equates to grand larceny, and robbing a train is a federal crime. The impulse to brag was replaced by the necessity to shut your trap, and after a week's worth of backslapping, a month's worth of shut mouths irritated the local force until the time for any leniency had passed. The usually good-humored local law enforcement, the feds breathing down their necks, would persecute to the fullest extent of the law. They had to. It was now a crime on the national radar. The Blues stood out true to their word, too. Collared on the corner of Copper and Antimony Streets, Penpurse couldn't figure out who'd turned code on him, but it didn't really matter. The hammer stroke had fallen on him. Out on bail, he faced 5-20, and the truck tires hammered the cattle guard, rattling the fissures where the hammer had forced his nerves apart. The rumble carried over the hills and gullies of the palace, where the old mine dumps bleached the valley 100 miles in any direction outside of Birch's city limits. Here, the dust and snow had gathered on the broken stones of early spring, a final exhalation falling to cover the hoof prints of the wild horses still running in the gullies. Spooked by the cattle rattle, the horses ran the darkened ridgeline. Penpurse drove. He chomped a toothpick, and a smug grin turned the stubbly corners of his mouth up into dimples. Technically, he had joined the company of Butch Cassidy and Jesse James. But when he got close to slapping his knee about that fact, the presence of his sister Barb, who rode shotgun with all the gravitas of a mildewed sack of Idaho golds, reminded him of his grim future prospects. They turned their heads when, in a shattering of bark, a crow loosed its hold on the single black pine, still standing to challenge the dust. The bird hung for a moment in the green-gray light that furred the Flint Creek Range before dawn. The world had yet to round and remained flat in its motion, like sheet metal gliding on a silted flooring. The crow drifted down to the clotted smelter waste and hard scrabble. It was a good place for campfires and rifle sighting. It gave people cancer. Pimper set his knees under the steering wheel and shifted the rig into neutral. He popped the lid off his chew can and pinched out a dip. Recapped, he threw the can on the dash and spit through the hole in the floorboards down into the clutch. Road silt plumed through the floor in quick spouts. The suspension creased, old and loose, and Barb's head dipped to touch the window glass. She removed her hairband and shook out the length strands that had become sticky with neglect. She hadn't washed in over a week. She'd bonded Penpurse on loan and wasn't sure she could cover. She wiped the tears out of her eyes. "Quit sulking," Penpurse said. Barb came across, punching at Penpurse's face. "You won't," Barb said. "Not today, you dumb bastard." Penpurse slammed his head back against the seat into the rattlesnake skins draped in the elbows of the gun rack. They had not been taken down from last year's kill and were as hard and slim as catgut. Some moldered where the muscle and blood hadn't been scraped clean, and their putrescence flurried in the cab a quick blizzard. Penpurse slapped at his neck. He chewed rapidly, his tongue and his flesh crawled with snake dust and guilt, and both spread hives down his spine. He rolled down the window. It didn't help. As usual, the itch was too much for him. He stopped the truck and put the brake on, stepped out to slap out his coat. He rubbed at his cold, damp nose and slammed his jacket off the side panel. He did it again. He swung on the truck until he had beat all hell out of the fender he possibly could and threw the coat into the road. Spent, he leaned on the road, on the open door, and spit. "Look," he said, "we're running hot here." He glanced at his sister. She was his oldest friend and the only one he could talk to without a gullet full of swill. She leaned her chin into her hand. Penpurse retrieved his coat and wiped the last of the snake's remains off of the headrest before he got back into the truck. "What about it?" he asked. "All right," she said. "But this snake killing is a lot of shit work." Barb crossed her arms. "It's the job." "Who's this job for?" Barb asked. "What's the pay? You get hazard? It's not like we got a shortage of things need to be paid around here, Pen." The sun spilled. Frost at the edges of the windshield became blinding. On the crest of a near hill, the herd turned broad to soak in the new day's sun. Pimpers pulled his cap down over his eyes. The wind touched the ash and the snow that smothered the ground and moved it around. It was hard to live in the valley and almost harder to believe that it was once the largest horse ranch in the country, running with grass scored by the freshest streams this side of the Continental Divide. Now there wasn't a hint of growth that wasn't barked or sharp, save those poor horses, and they had to chew up and swallow anything that wasn't stone. Below the warming horses, the docks of the abandoned train dumps scattered along the steep ridges of oxidizing rail track, eroded down to furred brace bolts and nests of brittle duff, that would forever smell of kerosene. Or the ditches gathered bed springs, rocks, and broken bottles, the hills began, and rail ties piled into the arroyo washes. Pimpers swung up out of a gully and wound up the road through the pouch of ancient and faulty shaft braces that had turned askew on each other over time. In any other landscape, the pile of dried logs would be an extreme fire hazard, but the valley and everything in it was sown with flame-retardant arsenic. Pimpers took his right before he reached the beams and cut away from the road across the fine loam, pulling his bandana up over his mouth and ears. Barb did the same. The truck stamped track in the earth, and the dust fell into the cab. "You know, Barb," Pimpers said, "killing snakes is bigger than us." Barb stretched. "That's stupid. How'd Nanorfeet die?" "Okay, how'd she die?" The heat blasted out of the dashboard. Their faces were hot. "Snake bit." "You're damn right, snake bit," Pimpers said. "And I can't count on my toes how many more ranchers and their dogs have thanked me for not being dead or in a whole lot of discomfort." Pimpers turned the knob on the heater and the windshield fogged. He turned it back. "Well, you can't eat thank you," Barb said. "Seems like killing snakes is just you doing the first thing that comes to mind to do again." "How's that?" "Come on, Pin. You've been the first to do something just to do anything since day one." Barb turned her head to watch the frost and the sage grass flare in the sunlight. "Don't matter if it's killing snakes to kill time because you don't know what or have nothing else to do before you get sent to the pen. It's why you're robbing trains at all, and, as you say, you can't count on your damn toes how many times it's gotten your ass skinned that you can take to the bank." Pimpers rounded down the hill, maneuvering slowly through the rock outcroppings that led up into the granite cairn. Steam drifted from a deep seam in the stone. He stopped the truck. Barb got out and put her hands to her hips. She looked at the sweat beating on her lip and bent to touch her toes. She stood, dragging from underneath the truck a limp cord of dead serpent, and she thrust the body of the crushed snake at Pimpers like it was the proof of something. Pimpers killed the engine. He wanted to make a joke about his tender disposition and how it would play in his prison life so the bar would keep the snake away from him. Instead, he pulled his bandana down when the dust settled. "Look at this guy," Barb said. Blood spilled off the snake and down her elbow, spackling her boots. "He's got two heads." Pimpers reached for the carcass. Barb shielded it, the snake. "Don't you touch it, you grabby-handed shit. He's mine." "Now how the hell am I supposed to see it if you don't let me see it?" Pimpers asked. He spat, waited, flicked the tobacco out of his mouth with his tongue. She resigned, straightened the snake out on the hood of the truck. Spanning from grill to windshield, the snake's head had been crushed and its snout bent oddly around the lower jaw. Its fangs were tucked back in its mouth. The truck tire had split the tail end on a rock, and the busted pods of rattle, blood darkened and shattered, appeared to be a second mangled head. The blood of this mythical beast ran a short distance in the dimples of the rock, in the dimples of the truck hood before thickening, then freezing stone solid. "Look here too," Barb said. "He's got little wings on him." Barb pointed to two patches of scale flared out like bat wings. A bulge in the snake's belly dropped down near them. Barb poked the lump and crushed neonates birthed onto the hood, and the flared scales retracted. On cue, Pinpurse pulled shovels from the truck bed and handed one to Barb. "Spring babies," he said. "What we're here for." Barb gripped the handle of her shovel. "Better clear them first," she said. In a game the two'd played since they could start trouble and they'd busied themselves in the rocks while their father tended the horses, Pinpurs and Barb walked toward the snake pit where it nestled in a thin crack hove into the earth by time. From that crack under a shelf of rock that turned up at the edges like a saucer, the snake's stink rose with the steam from their collected bodies. They approached the den mouth, pushing the noses of their shovels through the dirt before them. Barb's shovel turned on a length of body, and she drove the spade through the snake clear into the ground. Separated from its body, the mouth still worked on the severed head, opening and closing, working the venom out of its glands. Barb booted the head aside and continued to prod the dirt around the entrance to the pit, bothering a few small snakes from the rocks, which the siblings soon took apart. The ground cleared, Pimpers fired the rig and backed it up carefully, edging near to the den. Barb took the hose out of the truck and pushed one into the muffler. She stopped up the exhaust with a ball of socks, and the fumes flowed down through the hose. She fed the free end into the hole. Pinhurst revved the engine. Exhaust roiled up from the nest. The truck idled, and Pinhurst got out of the cab. The morning had warmed a bit, and the world filled with the sound of steady dripping and whispering stones, the hush of dry bodies slithering over stone. Bothered by the hose and the taste of exhaust, the snakes closest to the mouth of the den deserted slowly, colder than the others at the bottom of the burrow where the tangle created a live furnace. After months in the dark, the cold and bright day overwhelmed them, and the siblings worked at a controlled place, rocking from foot to foot, shifting their weight, turning furrows in the ground with their heels. The dust came out from under the snow, and it covered rock and skin and spade. Then blood melted the snow and dampened the silt. A few snakes made it past the executioners to the rocks. Other asphyxiated bodies ceased mid-slither at the opening of the den. The snakes that had been sleeping deep in the ground had already choked dead on fumes. Pinhurst felt better having slaughtered him some snake. He pulled the last of the train beers from behind the seat and threw one to his sister. The spray flecked his blood-spattered hands. Both of them blew heat back into their fists. "I must have got 20, Pinhurst said. "Maybe 6, Barb said. Pinhurst slapped his sister's shoulder. They had practiced forgetting over the years. He tried to recall what, but he'd forgotten. Barb emptied her can and threw it into the rocks. "You're a pro," Pinhurst said. Barb punched his arm. The truck sputtered and then died. "What you do?" Barb asked. "Nothing," Pinhurst said. He hopped into the cab, but the truck wouldn't turn over. He popped the hood and tinkered. He came up off the engine block. Coolant was at an acceptable level. He came around the rear and followed the line of hose toward the den. A kink had been creased in it during the melee, backing up the exhaust, and the blockage had stalled the truck out. Sweat cooled on Pinhurst's neck and tickled his shoulders. All around him, halves of snakes sprung powdered spasms in the dust. Barb nodded at the popping bodies, shrugged, and glugged down another beer. Some color came to her cheeks. It was full daylight and everything possible. They'd be all right, wouldn't they? Pinhurst wrapped the hose, pulling it around his shoulder and elbow. He neared the mouth of the den, and as he did, to the west of the cracked stone, the horses neared. Led by a dirty stallion, their clustered herd arched over a hill, and Pinhurst, watching them run, noticed too late a timber drifting out from the rocks. He felt it in the ground. His arm hair prickled. He held very still. A pace from his boot, the smallest constriction of scales shifted the sand before the snake coiled, its clovis head arched out over its body. At the tail end of that first horrible gear of the world, in the tiny cages, the pellets of hardened skin crashed, a pitch hurried well beyond warning. Fume drunk with lathered fangs, the snake struck. Pinhurst tensed. It was all he had time to do. There was not premonition nor flash. No sight of a young sister walking barefoot on a post fence at dusk or her warming her hands by the stove. There was only a clinching before the snake's coarse hide fell on his neck and went sliding over his shoulder. This, the king of snakes, had speared wide and stretched to full length, fell draped over Pinhurst's torso like a sash. For an instant, he cradled the limp body before casting it to the ground and beheading it. A crow circled close to the ground. "Where is it?" Barb asked. "Where did he get you? We got to suck the blood." "Missed," Pinhurst said. "Missed you?" "Missed," he said again. And he felt strangely disappointed. His hands quivered. He rubbed them together, and in so doing, ironed out the fear of ending and the guilt of wanting ends, of wanting anything, let alone to be saved from what had been scribed in the wavering range line. Dirt, addiction, disaster, prison. All inevitable as the horizon and just as impassable. And the horses came over the hill. They turned to and fro at intervals to avoid something that only they could see. They slowed and snorted at the dazed siblings, the stalled out truck, the blood on the ground. "Dirt chickens," Barb said, and this broke Pinhurst free from his brain. The horses were small. In them, time had rotted the shared bloodline of the valley's original purebreds. On long, thin necks, the horses held high their proud heads. Where they had bitten each other, open woods on their flanks and necks wept a curd. They pawed the ground, and pine brambles and burrs shook stove up in their tails. Their hides were thick from winter and spotted with small scars where locals had dinged them with pellets from air guns. They shook out their manes. In deeper spring, the air would have teemed with ticks and horse flies, but the winter had at least cured them those infestations. The lead stud, Royal White, had he not been so filthy, stood even with Pinpurse's shoulders. His wide black eye focused on the dead snake at Pinpurse's feet. The stallion, having arrived, seemed not to know what came next, and Pinpurse stepped forward. The horse turned and yipped and kicked. He bit the rump of the mare nearest to him, who reared, and the herd went mad. The horses bucked, snapping each other's mouths, closed and thumping rib cages with their broken hooves. Taking form behind the grimy stallion again, they ran like an ancient river on the valley floor. Pinpurse touched his mouth. "Let's go after them," Barb said. She pulled Pinpurse to follow. "They're amazing. Up close, I forgot how amazing." "A walk would be all right," Pinpurse said. "Get my blood moving." Barb was already after the horses. Pinpurse prodded the Serpent King with his boot and pulled the shovel free from the ground. He collected the head. Like the others, even the King of Snakes found little resolve in death, and severed, the jaw still worked, jutting fangs rippling at the lips. This life was not a terribly harsh one, but remained constant and cruel in its boredom. It was relentless as the winter and as relentless as Barb out on the dust pursuing horses. But it did end, could end. Pinpurse pressed the head of the snake into his breast pocket, just over his heart for safekeeping. He got along then, and came up upon Barb pointing down across the valley to where the stallion twisted on its back, taking a bath in the dust. It thrashed about like to put out flames. Near them, at the bottom of a scree slope, a crow worried something in a scrabble of stones. Pinpurse chucked a rock at it, and the bird hopped off a pace before it again perched on the hoof of the dead foal, cocked its head, and commenced pecking out the horse's prolapsed asshole. Pinpurse threw another stone that hit near, and the bird flew off. The carcass was days old, the stomach distended. The cold had kept it from going putrid, but the dogs would get at it soon, when the heat worked the stink up and the stomach eventually burst. It wouldn't take long now, and the thoughts of dogs, their slaver, their spit, their noise, shook Pinpurse the same as if an axe had been driven into his hip. The foal was snake bit. Two swollen punctures in its gross muzzle had split into stars. Pinpurse poked at it with his boot, and the way he moved pushed the biting fangs into his chest. He clutched at it and wept as he bent over the young, dead animal. "Oh no," Barb said. "It's okay, Pin." "I can't do the time, Barb." "You're going to do time, Pin. You're going to have to." "I won't," Pinpurse said. He put a tremoring finger to the snake head over his heart. It was fixed in his breast. If he had a thought then, he didn't finish it, but unearthed a large flat stone and drug it broadside onto the horse. Barb watched him drop the stone, and the ribcage collapse under its weight and the stomach deflate. He used smaller stones after, placing them on the carcass until he had built a loose mound over the animal. He had kneeled next to it, his breath coming out hot and wet and pained. All the adrenaline had frozen up in his joints, all the blood in his body jamming together. He was not sure what would happen now, but it had already hurt. He sat down on a stone and glanced back toward the footfall he and his sister had left in shallow snow and silt. His palms open, turned up into a shrug of resignation. His brow gleamed wet with perspiration and was bloated and paltry like someone had blown air between his skull and the skin on it. "Didn't mean to shake you," Barb said. Pinpurse opened his mouth to answer, and something vile and daisy-hued pumped out of his throat, and he tilted over. Flared like a wing, his open jacket exposed a small crimson swatch pooled in his shirt pocket. Barb popped the buttons on his shirt down to his navel. Above his heart, two fangs pierced his breast pocket and hung from two angry welts where two thin trickles wept venom. Barb removed the fangs and sucked at the wound. The venom wouldn't draw much, and she ran. She ran toward the truck, ran until acid pooled in her throat and her foot was on the accelerator. The truck shuddered and stalled. Barb sucked air hard through her nose, drummed her fingers on the dashboard in a prayer of patience before her slow, intentional turn of the keys eventually turned the truck over, and she moved in his direction. Pain muting his vision, Pinpurse cringed when the oil pan dropped off the first low ridge of stones and hung up the chassis. Throwing the truck into four low, Barb scraped off of the snag. The tires tamped the silt. The transmission groaned. The first rush of panic constricted each of their necks. Pinpurse forced his eyes open, searching now for a sister who crept the failing truck forward. Two urges toward each of them. One was the urge to just let him pass. And the other was a desperation to preserve life. Barb inched forward, and Pinpurse, resigned to the pain, thought only of horses. Too late, he understood that the Prince of Horses, for the death of his young, had come that day to administer a terrible vengeance upon the snakes, only to find his retribution stolen by fools.